you all for joining our call today with Paul Donovan, Chief Economist of UBS Global Wealth Management. I am Jill Orlando, Relationship Manager with the Chance Mantione Group. And before we begin, just a few housekeeping items. Everyone is currently muted. If you would like to ask a question, please email it to thechancemantionegroup@ubs, as we will be monitoring that email throughout the call. Also, please note, this call will be recorded for our podcast series, Relentless Pursuit with the Chance Mantione Group. Now I would like to introduce and hand the call over to Andrew Chance.
Thank you, Jill. Thanks, everybody, on the call today. Paul Donovan is always one of our most popular guests, and it seems like we always talk around this time of year, which is fantastic. I'm looking forward to our time today. So, Paul, thank you for joining us.
Thanks very much indeed for having me along again.
Excellent. So some listeners may have heard Paul's name invoked by Senator Sherrod Brown of Ohio when in his opening remarks to the Senate Banking and Finance Committee, but in their discussions with Fed Chair Jerome Powell. We'll come back to those remarks in a second. But I guess our first question is, what's your take on Powell's comments yesterday? It seems like we've all gotten comfortable with the idea that the Fed was going to be slowing down on rate hikes, eventually coming to a stop. Now it seems like that's not the case. What are your thoughts on what's going on kind of real time, Paul?
Well, honestly, I mean, I'd say I'm disappointed, but I'm becoming used to being disappointed by the Fed chair. Time and again, Powell has been asked, you know, what are you doing? What is it you are hoping to achieve by raising rates? And we never get an answer. We don't know what Powell thinks raising rates is going to achieve. And that really matters because this is not a normal cyclical inflation story. There isn't a credit bubble. There's not a huge liquidity imbalance. We don't have spiraling wages. Well, we do have spiraling wages. They're just spiraling downwards. Real wage growth has been absolutely abysmal in the United States. And so what is it Powell is trying to achieve by raising rates? Is that the failure to give us the transmission mechanism that he expects means that markets don't really know what to look at. All Powell keeps saying is inflation's high, so we must raise rates. Well, A, that ignores a whole host of economic theory, which, you know, Powell is presumably just simply unaware of. But B, it means that we don't know how to judge the risks around Fed policy. And it's adding unnecessary volatility, I think, into the financial markets. So I'm not surprised by the market's reaction yesterday. Powell was sounding hawkish, but not really giving us any reason why he's sounding hawkish, other than inflation is high, which every economist could have told him it's going to take a little while this year for inflation to come down.
So let's talk about that a little bit. You know, I wrote about or borrowed some of your ideas on one of your recent blog posts on the composition of the metrics used to track inflation have been influenced by what were the biggest impacts previously and in terms of in the US and Europe and how that might impact rates going forward. What do you think is actually going on in inflation and how is the Fed not getting this right? Shouldn't you just raise rates and that makes inflation go away?
Well, no, raising rates doesn't make inflation go away necessarily. It can indeed make inflation worse. And arguably that has been the case because by raising rates, Powell has, if not crashed, done a certain amount of damage to the real estate sector and new home buying. And as a result, pushed up rents in the rental market because people are renting, not buying, and pushing up rents then impacts inflation. So what we have got at the moment is primarily a profit-led inflation story. And this isn't profits because demand is, you know, running at a record pace. This is profits because demand is okay and companies have been able to convince customers that it's fair that the prices are going up. That, you know, it's not our fault. We don't want to raise prices. The war in Ukraine, supply chain disruption means that prices have got to go up. Well, the war in Ukraine is doing very little to inflation, almost nothing to inflation in the United States, and not that much in Europe, to be perfectly honest. And supply chain disruption is a myth. You know, we've got record global supply of goods, record global trade. Trade hit an all-time high of 24% of GDP last year. absolutely astonishing numbers. And yet somehow this narrative of, oh, you know, we can't manage supply chain disruption, we don't want to raise prices, but we've got to do it, is being sold. Now, I'm not blaming companies for doing this. I mean, companies are going to try and raise profit margins whenever they can. But Powell, by ignoring this, is saying, well, we've just got to raise rates. But raising rates isn't going to change the story that companies are telling. But it may encourage companies to say, look, you know, and the cost of credit's going up, so we're going to have to raise prices even further. What needs to be happening is an honest dialogue without all of the partisan hoopla and bias about what's behind inflation in the US and in Europe. I mean, it's the same story in Europe, not in Japan, not in Switzerland, not in parts of Asia, but in most of the Eurozone, the UK and the US, companies have been expanding margin and driving the inflation story. And we need to have a sensible discussion about what is the most appropriate policy response to manage that. And it's not necessarily raising rates with, you know, a maniacal fury in the way that Powell has been doing.
Is there a way to have that conversation in a nonpartisan manner at this point in time?
I'm not sure it's possible to do anything in a nonpartisan manner in the United States anymore, I have to say. I think it is. I think you can have a sensible discussion. And I think that, frankly, the Fed is one of the institutions that should be leading a sensible discussion and saying, look, you know, this is what's going on. And funnily enough, just today, the former vice president of the European Central Bank, Vittorio, just came out with a similar piece of analysis saying, actually, it's profit margin expansion, which is driving the Eurozone inflation. And it's very clinical and it's very analytical and it's not about, you know, profiteering or greedflation. You're not using emotional words. It's, look, here are the numbers, here are the facts. If we want to see lower inflation, we need to squeeze profit margins. Not just the bank, the European Central Bank, the Bank of England, or one of the Bank of England Monetary Policy Committee members gave a speech this morning, again, setting out that UK inflation is exactly caused by these same things. And so we've had these very neutrally worded, careful, analytical pieces of research in Europe and in the UK. We're not getting that from Powell. Fair enough. You know, maybe this is not Powell's forte. He's not an economist. But we're not getting it from the Powell Fed more generally. And I think that if they were to lead a national discussion, what that does is raise questions about, okay, well, how should we be slowing demand to squeeze profit margins? Is that the appropriate response? Should we be creating social pressure on companies not to be expanding profit margins at a time when a lot of people are suffering under the cost of living pressures? Different policy to monetary policy, but again, an objective analysis by the central bank, as we have just today in the last 24 hours had from both the ECB and the Bank of England, is, I think, an appropriate way to move forward.
So sort of profit margin shaming in the public square might
well
work.
Exactly. Well, not the public square, something far worse, the court of public opinion that is Twitter, or God help us all, TikTok. Because that actually, I think, is an interesting case that we have seen instances where companies have squeezed margins and cut prices because they're losing customers, either because the court of public opinion has turned against them or because customers are simply rebelling against their price increases. So in the UK, 2 weeks ago, Waitrose, which is one of the higher end supermarkets in the UK, suddenly came out and announced, we're cutting prices 14%.
Wow.
14%. I mean, this isn't, you know, well, you know, we'll give you a special discount and it's you know, 5% off. No, 14% cut on 300 of their own label items. And the reason is because consumers were saying, actually, you know what? We don't believe the story. We don't think this is a fair price increase. We're moving. So now you've got significant price discounting. My mother is delighted by this. My mother is somebody who is a keen fan of price discounting in all of its forms. So you're seeing this sort of public pressure come through. And I think actually it will be interesting to see that if this narrative does get caught up in social media, if this becomes a focus in social media, I think you could see certain sectors come under an awful lot of scrutiny and an awful lot of pressure very, very quickly. And that may then lead to some more significant price changes. As we've already seen in certain areas of the economy, I've already mentioned in the UK with one supermarket. We've seen it in Norway over food prices as well. But we're seeing it in some areas with auto prices, for example, where car prices are coming down. It's partly Tesla, but other factors coming through as well. So this is something to keep an eye on, I think, over the course of the next 2-3 months.
So just to talk a little bit about corporate earnings a little more, then, you know, a lot of analysts, UBS included, has been lowering their corporate earnings estimates for the S&P 500, which obviously could have implications for valuations. But based on what you're talking about in terms of the high levels of profit margins, does that make sense right now to be lowering corporate earnings? Do we feel that those things are going to be going down?
Well, of course, it is the job of an equity analyst to try and predict the future. It's the job of an economist to know the future and for analysts to try and predict the future. So this is not inappropriate, I think, because what we are seeing is essentially, you know, the equity analysts are saying, perhaps with some guidance from some companies, we think that these profit margin expansions are coming to an end and that we are going to see some pressure building. So essentially, I think what the equity analysts are betting on is the tightening of profit margins and the lowering of inflation over the next 6 to 9 months. That's what the equity analysts are saying is likely to be coming true. The cost pressures will slow as well, but after 2 years where prices have been rising far faster than costs have, we're now entering into a phase where prices are going to be rising more slowly than costs. Well, I think both cost inflation and price inflation will be slowing down, but the price inflation will be slowing down that little bit more. And that implies some squeeze in earnings. So we've already been seeing, as you were quite rightly saying, we've been seeing some correction. I'm not talking about devastating earnings growth. I mean, I think it is going to be negative, but I don't think it's going to be devastating because there's still a reasonably solid level of underlying demand. It's just, you know, the margin has got to be trimmed back a bit on every item sold or every service offered. And so that suggests moderately negative, but not sort of disastrously negative earnings growth over the course of this year. I'm not an equity analyst or an equity strategist, but the idea of sort of a -2%, -3% earnings growth this year seems to me to be fairly reasonable, given what I would be expecting to happen with the inflation story and the pricing power of various companies.
Well, I do know the local deli has serious pricing power because I just paid $10 for a tuna salad sandwich, which seemed excessive to me. But
excessive by London standards, certainly.
That was a little excessive. So given what you started out saying about Powell and what he perhaps doesn't know what he's trying to accomplish or not communicating what he's trying to accomplish, and your thoughts here on inflation coming down, at what point do you see sort of the crossover? Do you expect, maybe it's too hard to tell, not knowing what Powell's really thinking about, when will inflation come down to a point where they can stop just sort of randomly raising rates?
I think that if we had a Fed chair who was forward-looking, who had a plan about how to manage inflation, then you'd be stopping now, because you would be looking at the leading signs, you'd be looking at the, you know, the percentage of prices that are rising by less than 2% on an annualized basis, which is a growing share of the CPI basket. You'd be looking at what equity analysts are saying, and you'd be saying, actually, you know what, we at least need to pause because it does look like inflation is going to come down. But that's because you are basing your policy on what is going to happen, what's not what is happening in real time. I think the challenge with Powell is that he lives in the now. He's not prepared to think ahead, in which case inflation has to come down further. Now, I think if we are talking about inflation rates of sort of somewhere between 4% and 5% in the States for headline inflation by the middle of this year, which I think is a very realistic scenario. So headline consumer price inflation, headline PCE deflator coming in somewhere between 4% and 5%. At that point, I think the trajectory of inflation has been sufficiently steeply down that Powell and the rest of the Fed will take a decision to pause on rates. Maybe not on quantitative policy. I think that the quantitative policy tightening could carry on, and I think that's quite right, because that's motivated by slightly different factors. But on the rates, I think you could say, actually, you know what? This summer, we're calling a halt. We don't need to go further. And then the question, I think, rapidly becomes, as we continue to see inflation falling, how quickly do they move from we're going to stop hiking to maybe we should be considering a cut in rates? I think that probably requires clear signals in the labor market as well as inflation. So you would need to see nominal wage growth slowing down. As I said, I'd expect prices to fall more rapidly than nominal wage growth is going to be declining. But if nominal wage growth is coming down sufficiently quickly by the end of the year, then I think, you know, the debate is naturally going to change to, okay, you know, when and how much are they going to start cutting?
Paul, hey, it's Tom Mantione. Thanks again for joining us. You mentioned the quantitative portion of this, and something that, you know, exploded at the start of the pandemic was, you know, M2 money supply. And for the first time in, gosh, as long as I can remember looking at money supply, it actually declined in 2022.
Yeah.
Do you have a view on that as a either a tool in this discussion or some form of tea leaves?
Not great as a form of tea leaves. So the issue here is that when we're thinking about inflation or indeed general economic activity, you can't just look at money supply. Printing money never ever creates inflation. Printing too much money creates inflation. And that is the most important distinction in inflation economics. Because how do you judge if there is too much money being printed? Well, you consider money supply relative to money demand, or liquidity supply relative to liquidity demand or liquidity preference. So if you think about what's happened over the course of the pandemic, when the pandemic starts, people are saving money because you can't spend. And people are actually saving money in very liquid form. I mean, in many cases, it's literally cash in a shoebox underneath the mattress. And so the demand for money goes up. And the Federal Reserve, quite rightly, in my view, meets that surge in demand for cash by increasing the supply of cash. And so as a consequence of that, M2 and other monetary aggregates go up on the money supply side, but that is reflecting an increase in money demand. Now, what has happened over the last 18 months is that Americans have been rooting around underneath their beds, pulling out the shoebox full of cash and rushing out to buy, you know, the latest sports utility vehicle or flat screen TV or whatever it is. And so the demand for liquidity in 2022 was going down because the savings were no longer being hoarded under the bed. They were actually being put to work in the economy. And people were saying, no, we don't want to hoard cash anymore. We don't demand the liquidity. So as the demand for liquidity came down, the supply of liquidity came down. So the surge in demand of liquidity back at the start of the pandemic and the negative liquidity that we see in 2022, in my view, is more a reflection of a very unusual savings story we had both in the pandemic and then immediately after it with this, you know, the American consumer's relentless pursuit of hedonism. And so that, I think, is what's been going on there. I don't think that we can say liquidity conditions are especially tight in the United States, even though the money supply has come down, because I think the drop in liquidity demand has been so significant. I mean, if you look at the collapse in the savings rates, household savings rates in the States have come down very, very rapidly in the last year. That, to me, suggests it's sort of a more balanced picture. And so I'm afraid to say that whilst it would be lovely if we did have this as a reliable set of tea leaves, it's not perhaps terribly, terribly good.
Thank you for that.
So, Paul, we did just get a question here. I'm going to try and read this as it's been written. So, someone's thanking you for your time here today. How does consensus year over year S&P 500 earnings per share growth dovetail with Fed policy? With consensus fourth quarter 23 year over year at plus 10% and 2024 year over year plus 12%, which both seem absurdly high. As a practical matter, does the Fed need to drive those two numbers negative, either in forecast or reality?
So when we are talking about S&P earnings, we have to be a little bit careful. So there's a number of things to bear in mind. Number one, the S&P is not the economy. The S&P is a very, very minor part of the economy. Listed companies, so that's the Russell 3000, account for about 40% of private sector GDP in the States. The majority of private sector activity, the majority of employment, the overwhelming majority of private employment is mom and pop stores. It's the small business sector. So we need to remember that when the Fed is interested in the economy And you know, the S&P 500 is not exactly a footnote in that, but it's not necessarily the dominant part. Second, the composition of the S&P is nothing like the composition of the economy. The S&P is very tech-heavy, for example. Now, that may lead you to question the projected earnings growth of the S&P by the consensus, but there is a difference between profits as measured by S&P companies or earnings as measured by S&P companies and the broader earnings in the economy. So that's also important to bear in mind. And third, and this is a critical one, because it's something which affects now all equity markets. In the US, with the S&P, I think I am right in saying almost half of all S&P earnings come from outside the United States now. So if you are a company that's selling in China, then you know, the Chinese domestic demand story is going to be very different from the US domestic demand story this year. And the China part of your operations are going to be affected differently in terms of potential earnings growth to the US part of your operations. So different countries' equity markets don't necessarily reflect the domestic demand conditions. I think it is fair to say that the S&P and other developed markets tend to affect developed economy conditions. So you know, it's a slightly broader position. But we have to be quite careful in some of the analysis here and in some of what we're looking at. So I think the consensus numbers are probably optimistic, well, I think certainly are optimistic for S&P earnings, and will come down. Bear in mind, the consensus calculation doesn't operate in real time. So the analysts change their forecast, and the consensus number will reflect that change in forecast maybe 6-8 weeks later. So at the start of this year, you know, analysts have been revising their forecast. The consensus expectation, you know, it grinds pretty slowly, to be perfectly honest. And as somebody who, in my former life in the investment bank, you know, I used to participate in the consensus surveys until we gave up and said, no, we're just not going to bother, and withdrew from them. There's a considerable lag before this stuff actually necessarily gets published. So I think that the actual consensus for S&P earnings probably has come down for the fourth quarter already. It's just not being properly reported. But then it is subject to these other factors, which mean that the S&P earnings is not necessarily going to be a principal concern of the Fed, because the Fed's interested in the US economy, which is far more Main Street than it is Wall Street.
I'm not sure if you ever get a chance to talk to Greg Poole of our Knowledge Network, but he used a phrase last week when he was talking about there was discussions of hard landings, soft landings, and now he's brought out the term of no landing, that there's not necessarily going to be a flattening or recession or whatever you want to call it. What do you think happens over the next 6 months to a year in terms of the economy and in terms of business? Do you feel like there's a major slowdown that's going to happen? Do you feel like we're not really going to feel it, or has it already happened and we're just sort of cruising out of it?
So I think we are going to see a slowdown in consumer spending. So that's a slower rate of growth of consumer spending. I'm not saying necessarily negative, but I think negative would be surprising. But I think there will be a slowdown in the pace of growth. And I think that will continue. It's already happening, and it will continue over the next 6 months or so. But I think that slowdown is not going to be evenly distributed. So I think you will have some parts of the economy where things will feel a lot tougher, and some parts of the economy where you won't notice there's a slowdown at all. So fairly obviously, the construction sector is weakening, which is hardly a surprise. The US economy is not actually terribly interest rate sensitive, but the construction sector is obviously an interest rate sensitive sector. And so what we are seeing there, I think, is underemployment. We're not actually seeing companies closing and job losses, but we're seeing underemployment. So somebody who, you know, may have been a construction worker 5-6 days a week is now driving an Uber 2 days a week, for example, yeah, that kind of thing. So that's a sector, I think, where you are going to get, you've already got, frankly, a fairly noticeable slowdown. I mean, it's not, you know, plunging over the edge into the abyss, but it's not great. If we are talking about consumer durable goods, again, consumers rushed out to buy their flat screen televisions in 2021 and early 22. Well, they've got them, and we've reached the limits there, and there's been a distinct slowdown in consumer durable goods demand. We're seeing that in Asian export data. We're seeing it in the sales numbers. We're absolutely seeing it in the inflation numbers, because the inflation numbers have turned negative, but outright deflation in this sector now. So that's an area where you've got really quite weak demand, because demand patterns have changed. But if we think about bars, restaurant spending, spending on leisure travel, that hasn't seen so much of a slowdown. And I think this is a structural shift that people are prioritizing experiences over the traditional sort of goods that people were focused on. And people are spending a bit more. And I noticed this coming into the office in London, that the flexible working arrangements mean that people are not in the office very often, and their spending habits have changed as a result. Because beforehand, you know, when you're coming into the office 5 days a week, the last thing you want to do is go and socialize with your colleagues in the evening. You know, you've been staring at them all day. That's it. You've had enough. You want to get out as quickly as possible, go home, have a nice cup of tea. But if you're coming into the office a couple of days a week or even less, then you get weirdly nostalgic for conversations with your colleagues from time to time. And people are going out and socializing in the evenings, and there's a bit more resilience to that sort of demand. So you can see we've got a really complicated picture, partly because of the pandemic, partly because of structural change. There are areas of the economy which I think are going to feel really very, very weak indeed, like construction. And we've got areas of the economy where, you know, like leisure travel, I don't think you're going to notice a slowdown at all. And as somebody who travels a lot for work, I mean, I can't remember the last time I had an empty seat next to me on the plane. It's a different sort of experience. So very mixed. I'm not a big fan of historical analogies, because historical analogies, every economic cycle is different. However, if I break all my rules and were to give a historical analogy, my sense is that the real economy, in terms of how it feels, not in terms of what's driving it, but in terms of how it feels, it's going to feel a bit like 2001. So it's going to be a bit soft, it's going to be a bit soggy, but at the end of the day, no one's going to really panic that they're going to lose their job. If you do lose your job, you'll probably find another one before too long. So I don't think it's going to be terrible this year, but there is going to be a slowdown from where we have been.
That's very interesting. You gave some good thoughts in terms of the remote work and return to work kind of concept, and at least impacts maybe on after work spending. Is there, we hear this conversation a lot from clients and different people. Have you seen a large economic impact, whether in the US or in Europe, in terms of, aside from just bar traffic, perhaps, in terms of the work from home or the hybrid work world, whether it's better or worse, does it all kind of come out in the wash?
Economically, this is probably better to have hybrid work. Now, I'm going to use the UK as an example here, not just because I'm British, but because actually the UK Office of National Statistics has done a lot of work on this. And because the UK is an economy that is more able to have flexible working than almost any other major industrialized economy, because the UK is a very service sector focused economy. It's a relatively small geographic space. And so things like commuting times are actually quite important to people here. And so people have been changing their working patterns. Now, the Office of National Statistics, regularly using panel data and other sources, come up with the percentage of people who are working flexibly. That is to say, they spend some part of the week working from home. Not necessarily the whole week, but some part of it. And I'm doing this from memory, but I think it's 47 or 48% of the workforce work from home at least part of the week in the UK. Now, what has happened as a result of that is we've seen some very direct changes. So there's a direct shift in real estate demand. We're using real estate more efficiently. UBS in London has leased out about 17% of its office space. Well, it's non-catering and non-meeting room office space. So you don't need it anymore. So we're using our space more efficiently rather than me having an empty office at home or an empty office in London. By reducing the total amount of real estate demand, I'm using the assets more efficiently. That's more productive. I'm not commuting so often. That gives me more time, which I may spend doing work or I may spend doing other things, but that's also more productive. So you're seeing these sort of shifts coming through. Now, a lot of people say, yes, but the Gen Z will never learn if they're not in the office talking to people. Absolute nonsense. I mean, the problem we got Gen Z in the office is prying them off the iPad or the iPhone in the first place. And interestingly, the UK ONS, in their regular survey, they look at the people who have the option to work from home and who choose to go into the office every single day for whatever reason. And it's about 14% of workers have the option to work from home and never use it. But for Gen Z, about 17% of people have the option to work from home and never use it. So what that's saying is that, yes, Gen Z is slightly more inclined to go to the office, but very, very slightly. The thing is that a lot of younger people do jobs where you actually have to go into the office, go into work, because you're doing entry-level, lower-skilled service sector jobs which require you to be there. You know, if you are a barista, you can't work from home, etc. That's all the direct stuff. Now, the really exciting stuff about flexible working, I think, comes in actually slightly tangentially. It's things like people building up side hustles, people setting up their own businesses. We've had this explosion of business creation during the pandemic and after it, in the US, in the UK, in parts of Europe, in Asia. And that's innovation. That's people being creative, you know, turning their hobbies into money spinners. If you're have a hobby of knitting sweaters and every member of your family and friend group has got five sweaters and is, you know, actively avoiding you whenever you approach them carrying a bundle, well, start selling on eBay. Start selling on Amazon Marketplace. Set up your own business. And actually, that's what we're seeing. So that's something which I think is, again, it's people saying, well, you know, I'm saving 2 hours a day by not commuting. I've got more free time to myself and I've got spare time at home. So I'm not getting at home, you know, after dark, exhausted and collapsing into an armchair and calling weakly for a glass of wine. Why don't I start using this time more constructively and start writing an economics book and selling it on Amazon, which is, you know, just a hypothetical example, or writing, you know, selling my sweaters or whatever it is. And so again, you're starting to get creativity and better use of people's skills and so on. So I think this is a net positive. There's all sorts of other things. It allows people with children to work, come back into the workforce to do jobs which are more productive and more suited to their skill base, all sorts of different things here. So flexible working, it's going to take some adjusting to, and people are management tend to be naturally suspicious of it. Not at UBS, I'm glad to say, but management do generally tend to be naturally suspicious of it. But the evidence so far is that this is adding to productivity, but disrupting the way that we live and work, changing our spending patterns, changing our real estate use, changing small business startups. So, you know, we've just got to be prepared for change.
That's always good advice. We just have a couple of minutes left. I promised I'd keep this somewhat short today. But so the last thing I'd ask you is there something that you're thinking about often and you're thinking to yourself, now, why didn't they ask me about that?
Good question. I mean, I come back to a point which I make very often, which I am still concerned about, that it's the problem of Bloomberg. It's the problem of CNBC. That's the problem with Fox News as well, at least Fox Business, that we're being asked time and again to provide an unrealistic level of precision in the economy. You know, I go on CNBC and I'll be berated by the host who's saying, well, you know, you said it was going to be 3% and it came in at 3.2. I shrug my shoulders and say, yes, well, I was right. It was broadly 3%. I mean, you know, that economics is not precise. And we're seeing that more and more now with the data. The revisions to data just continue to come in. You know, again, I've been looking at the German data this week. Every single number is revised up every time. Really, I mean, the Germans, it's becoming a joke. So we have got to stop obsessing as investors about the data and the precision of the data and try and remember to take a seat, calm down, look at the big picture, not worry about the short-term data points. And that, I think, is something we really need to do. The problem that we have, of course, is that we're in a world of soundbite economics where Twitter is blowing up every small difference in the number, where CNBC sort of pauses its programming to announce that non-farm payrolls came in 50,000 stronger than expected. I mean, that's a rounding error. It doesn't actually tell you anything. And so we need, I think, to be very, very mindful that it is the trend and the general direction that matters. And now more than ever, we need to be wary of getting overexcited about precision and whether the consensus expectations are being hit or missed, because this is not particularly precise. And the final point I'd make on this, which I think is something which really does need to be emphasized again, you keep hearing, oh, the number was weaker than consensus. The first question you've got to ask yourself is, how good is the consensus? So today, companies are just refusing to fill in consensus forms. It's time consuming. We don't have the time to do it. It's a nuisance to have to do. And, you know, we're giving something for free, which, you know, doesn't really benefit us. So we've stopped doing it. The result is that some of these consensus numbers, particularly for European economic data, there are three forecasts making up the consensus. And only one of those forecasts is done by an economist. The other two are done by random people plucked off the street, it seems to me. So we have to be very careful about how data is being reported. And I think it is always worthwhile challenging yourself, challenging the assumption, and saying, is that really a dramatic shift in terms of the data, or is it just sort of noise within a trend? And is the consensus really as good as we think it is? So I would encourage everybody, whenever you're seeing this sort of soundbite economics coming through from the various business television channels, shout at the screen and disagree with them. It's very therapeutic, and it will remind you that we're not in a precise world. We are in a world where we look at broad trends.
Sage advice for sure, Paul.
It would almost seem that you have been listening into a call I was on earlier today, Paul. That was pretty interesting. That is very sage advice that I would certainly agree with. Well, the time has gone quickly, as always, and I do reserve the right to ask you back. I know everyone likes and really enjoys your perspective on things. And again, thank you for being here at UBS, and thank you for all that you do for us and these great thoughts on the economy. So with that, thanks to everyone who was on the call. And Paul, thank you very much. Tom and Jill, thanks for helping out. And we look forward to speaking with you again soon, Paul.
Thanks very much.